Thank you for having me here. This is actually, my third trip around with PCN every 2 years so far. And so I've covered a fair bit of the country in different times. And it's always wonderful to see people in their situations and their questions, learn from you as well, because the Australian scene is one scene. I'm sure the English scene is different as well. So it's a mutual sharing of this information and these ideas. As Cliff said, this is the second last presentation. We've been a long way in these 3 weeks. I think we're up to 2,000 miles so far in the car. But, you are absolutely the privileged people tonight. Because when you try and organise something like this, you're told how many places you'll be visiting. You then have to guess how many books you might need, you might possibly sell. You have no idea what the audience sizes are going to be and therefore what you will sell in the way of books. The first time I came, I finished with one book left. The second time I finished with four. But somehow this time we've rather over-catered for books. And I have them printed here. The publishers do this now with print on demand. So I tell them how many I need, and they'll print them here in England. So we've got a surplus of books. And knowing that it's more expensive to take them home, ship them home to Australia, we have a great deal for you tonight. I'd rather get them out. The books normally, on Book Depository, my books range from anything from £16 to £25, and the Florence Nightingale goes up higher than that. So tonight we are offering the books at £15 for any book and £5 for second book, third book, fourth book. So you are very, very special. So basically it's two books for £20 and then £5 for any others that you might like. So so the first one's 15, and then after that they're £5 each. So you can rush afterwards. Tomorrow sitting over there, and hopefully we won't have to carry too many more on the way. A different book, I've got only four titles, I think, left there now. The Doubt one, which I'll talk a little about tonight, but obviously there's much more in the book. Like Catching Water in a Net, Human Attempts to Describe the Divine, that goes across religions, looking at how the divine or God, whatever name you use, has been talked about across religions, all written for lay people. The Stepping Out with the Sacred, the hardcover, is a sequel to that, and that one's called Engaging, Human Attempts to Engage the Divine Across Religions again. Lots of stories in that one. And the latest one is Testing Tradition, Liberating Theology, Finding Your Own Voice. I wrote that one because so many people, when I speak at things, think there's only one way to think, that there's only one theological position and there's only been one for the whole of history, which anyone who's studied theology will know that that's absolutely not true. So what I've done in that book, if you're interested in the back of different theological positions and what's changed, it's very much reader-friendly, and that covers the whole 21st centuries of changing theology. So that's where Morris is. My topic is celebrating doubt as a catalyst on the faith journey. And since you've been here tonight, you have no doubt had many doubts running through your head. Did I make the right choice in giving up my evening for this? I'm not sure if I turned off the stove or whatever you call it, the oven, or why does that woman think that shirt looks nice? Doubt is an important part of who we are, and yet in Christianity it has been named as the enemy. Across the world right now, people will be listening to stories in churches, secretly wondering if they can believe some of them. I say Christianity because I recently stumbled across the words from an 18th century Zen master that I wish I had found as a teenager. He said, "At the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. Small doubt, small awakening. No doubt, no awakening." Some 29 years ago, actually, I wrote the book In Defence of Doubt, An Invitation to Adventure. The book was very popular and was updated again and republished in 2012. So that's the edition I have tonight. So why did I write about doubt? because you write about what you know. And I certainly knew about doubt. The book was written in white heat the summer that our family moved back to the United States from Australia for a second term. Changing countries, as many of you know, is dislocating because you leave behind old friends, familiar rituals, and quite a bit of your history. But such moves are also first day of the rest of your life moments, where you have a chance to re-examine your life and your goals before getting caught up in a new schedule. I grew up in Australia as a God-intoxicated evangelical Christian, which meant that I couldn't sit next to anyone in the bus without feeling that I had to witness to them before they got off at their stop. Anyone else had that experience? Their destiny was my God-given responsibility. What if they died that night and didn't go to heaven? Yet all the while, I secretly doubted many of the teachings from an infallible Bible that simply had to be believed. I blamed myself for this weakness and for my arrogance in thinking that I could question issues of such magnitude. I desperately wanted to be rid of my doubts because in my church tradition, doubt was frowned upon. In fact, the more you could believe without question, the better Christian you were. Although the disciple Thomas, I think, asked quite a sensible question about seeing the evidence before he believed, he was demonised as a doubting Thomas because of the verse that followed. Blessed are those who believe without seeing the evidence. I went to university, gained graduate degrees in science and worked in research. In the University Evangelical Union, we dissected Bible verses with great skill, thinking ourselves great scholars. But there were always these hidden walls into which I would bump if I questioned certain things like a bodily resurrection, a virgin birth, inconsistencies in the Bible. And of course, these were the things that worried me. I remember the agony of convincing myself every night before sleep that Jesus' bodily resurrection did actually happen, only to wake up the next morning and as my eyes opened, I said, but did it really happen? After the career in science and then in the arts, I finally went back to university in midlife to do religious studies to find answers to my questions. I could no longer live with the emotional torture my doubts were still creating, and I was prepared to walk away from God and the church should it prove necessary. The moment I began New Testament studies, I discovered that all my questions had been openly debated in theological circles for centuries, and yet this had not reached the lay people in the pews. Why weren't we told, was my cry, as it is with so many people, when they realise that they have never been introduced to these discussions. Many of my classmates in religious studies were training to be ministers and priests, responsible for passing on what they had learned once they graduated. But they would not. What further incensed me was that faithful lay people were giving sacrificially towards the education of these future clergy, and yet they would be left with their doubts. So when I finished my PhD in theology, my goal was set to write for laity, to ensure others didn't go through the trauma of doubt that I did without access to good biblical scholarship. That's why in the summer of 1988 in America, I started putting down on paper what had been composting in me for many years. Religious doubts are not negatives, but the positives they are in every other area of life. The sand that irritates the oyster long enough to produce a beautiful pearl. It was time I paid attention to my doubt, rather than shamefully hiding them and squeezing my feet into someone else's certainties. At that time, unlike today, books celebrating religious doubt were rare. Most people only talked about successfully overcoming any doubts they had, once and for all. In fact, when the book came out in 1995, some people questioned the title. Why didn't you call it In Defence of Questioning? Although they acknowledged they had doubts, they felt more comfortable being a questioner than a doubter, which proves the point about the negativity that surrounds doubt. I had no idea how my book would be received when it was first published, but letters and phone calls flooded in from people who for the first time felt validated to own their doubts. The funny thing is, the book didn't really give new interpretations of key doctrines or problematical biblical texts. It simply pointed out that doubt in any area of life is healthy. And I was a scientist. The way we move from outdated, inadequate ideas to new and useful knowledge. Now, when you say it like this, it seems blatantly obvious, like arguing that we should be thankful we have enough to eat. Yet for many people, doubting religious beliefs is still not okay. And doubters have been and still are silenced and blamed. I did a swift Google of doubt and sin as I wrote this. And in the Articles of the Catholic Faith under the First Commandment, it says, voluntary doubt about the faith disregards or refuses to hold as true what God has revealed and the Church proposes for belief. Involuntary doubt refers to hesitation in believing, difficulty in overcoming objections connected with the faith, or also anxiety aroused by its obscurity. If deliberately cultivated, doubt can lead to spiritual blindness. So as not to implicate only Catholics, I went to the question and answer Christian website for advice. It said, doubt will lead to unbelief if it is not dealt with properly. To overcome doubt, which will not be 100% possible in this lifetime, we must pray and cry out to God to help our doubt, go back to the Bible, and search for the answers to our doubt, and to ask him to strengthen our faith in his word. God is the one who gives us faith. So the solution in both cases is more faith, more confession, less pride, really an affirmation that the doubter might be right and that some of the doctrines are leaking like sieves. The contemning of doubt in Christianity has been about power and control, and a large dose of fear if people start to think for themselves. I call this silencing of people theological abuse. We use the metaphor of family for the church, but many families are quite dysfunctional. Not only is the doubter violated by those in authority who wish to silence her, but she must internalise the belief that somebody else's authority can rightly substitute for her experience and that the violation is her fault. Doubters are expected to adopt a position of intellectual dishonesty while blaming themselves for their problems. As the late iconoclast Christopher Hitchens said, the religion which treats its flock as a credulous plaything offers one of the cruelest spectacles that can be imagined, a human being in fear and doubt who is openly exploited to believe in the impossible. As an aside, the best things about these new atheists like Hitchens is that they say out loud what the rest of us might be thinking or need to think. If doubters do publicly admit their doubts, it is usually at a point of desperation. Martin Luther, we didn't call him the great doubter, we called him the great questioner. Martin Luther endured years of agony before challenging church teaching. He wrote, although much of what the church said seemed absurd to me and completely alien to Christ, for more than a decade I curbed my thoughts with the advice of Solomon, do not rely on your own insight. I always believed, listen to this, I always believed there were theologians hidden in the theological schools who would not have been silent if these teachings were impious. The religion scholar Karen Armstrong wrote of hiding her doubts as a 17-year-old in a convent. For years I had told myself that black was white and white was black, that the so-called proofs for God's existence had truly convinced me, that I might not be feeling happy, but that I really was happy because I was doing God's will. I had deliberately told myself lies and stamped hard on my mind whenever it had reached out towards the truth. As a result, I had warped and incapacitated my mental powers. When Karen Armstrong finally voiced a particular doubt to her superior, the sister agreed that it couldn't be proved, but then she added, "Please don't tell the others." Everybody's faith story is different, but our particular story makes us who we are today and sets us on the paths that we pursue. Some people tell me they simply walked out of church in their teens or their 20s when their doubts became too great and they never went back. Others identify with my long struggle, remaining in the church with the hope that one day my questions will be addressed. Some tell me that doubts have never worried them, while others simply want permission to address their questions. A professional colleague who visited us soon after my doubts book came out was stunned when I explained what the book was about. Because we went to church, she assumed that we believed all the traditional doctrines. She'd been raised in a church where everything had to be believed under threat of hell, but no longer attended because she couldn't just believe. Yet she was riddled with guilt about this, especially as her family kept telling her she was a backslider. A few days after talking over some of the issues from the book, she was a different person. She didn't need any new explanations for the worrying doctrines. That could come later. All she wanted was permission to listen to her own logic and question boldly what didn't make sense and which had controlled her for years. My chains fell off. My heart was free. Was true in reverse. She had been freed to doubt. Jennifer Michael Hecht, in her wonderful History of Doubt, says, "The only thing such doubters really need, that believers have, is a sense that people like themselves have always been around, that they are part of a grand history. To be a doubter is a great old allegiance, deserving quiet respect and open pride." Hundreds of people are walking away from churches today. You have your own statistics. In Australia's last census, 28% of young people between 15 and 34 reported no religious affiliation at all. Scandals have been perpetuated by God's representatives to such a degree that in Australia, a royal commission into sexual abuse of children in church institutions is in progress, revealing horrific statistics. 7% of Catholic priests in Australia have been shown to be involved in child sexual abuse, and 40% in one particular order. And other denominations are not free from these abuse cases. Conservative Christian lobby groups are claiming that same-sex marriage will destroy the fabric of Christian society and marriage, even though only 29% of marriages in Australia in 2011 were performed by a religious leader of any kind, of any religion, and most were performed outside a church building. The new atheists receive attention today, both from those following their message and from the disenchanted, with inadequate answers in churches. Yet the majority of churches still promote a Christianity that demands we don't ask questions, but just believe. Religion has done a first-class job of packaging ultimate, not-to-be-challenged claims in interlocking doctrines which, like a row of dominoes, may all collapse if one section falls. When Alice says to the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland, "I can't possibly believe that," the Queen says, "Perhaps you haven't had enough practice." "Why," the Queen says, "I have believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." The funny thing is that while Christianity has tried to condemn doubters in the pew, honest, creative doubt has long been integral to the church's history. We have not acknowledged this because we have called our heroes and heroines brave questioners rather than the doubters they were. The psalmist raged against God's absence, and Job refused to be quiet, challenging God's fairness. Early Christianity was a ferment of doubt as different teachings about Jesus created conflicting theological camps. 4th century Roman Emperor Constantine insisted that the bishops agree on one orthodox truth to be spelled out in creeds, yet still they argued. And the medieval theologian Peter Abelard said, "The first key to wisdom is assiduous and frequent questioning. For by doubting we come to inquiry, and by inquiry we come to faith." We arrive at truth. I could go on and on with the list, but there's no time, and you're hoping that I won't, and you'll have to read the book where I give many examples. Doubters are still all around us in the most surprising places, often hidden from view, because we still pretend that everything is beyond question. Mother Teresa always springs to mind as an example of great faith, yet letters to her confessor, published after her death, tell of her years of darkness and doubt, even as she accomplished so much. She wrote, "This terrible sense of loss, this untold darkness, this loneliness, this continual longing for God, which gives me such pain deep down in my heart. Darkness is such that I really do not see, neither with my mind nor with my reason. The place of God in my soul is blank. There is no God for me. When the pain of longing is so great, I just long and long for God. And then it is that I feel he does not want me. He is not there." This was no fleeting experience for Mother Teresa. Continued through her life. In 1985, she told her confessor, "Father, I do realise that when I open my mouth to speak to the sisters and to people of God about God's work, it brings them light, joy and courage. But I get nothing of it. Inside it is all dark and feeling that I am totally cut off from God." A large part of our problem is that doubt has traditionally been promoted in hymns and sermons as the opposite of faith and belief. St. Francis's prayer, so often quoted, says, "Where there is sorrow, bring joy. Where there is doubt, faith." Hymns talk about driving the dark night of doubt away. On Sunday recently in church, three of the four hymns said something negative about doubt. Yet the opposite of faith is to be without faith. The opposite of belief is unbelief. Neither of these is doubt. Doubt is rather the discrepancy between faith and belief, between what we experience or intuit and what we are told to believe. Doubt emerges in the gap when belief systems don't line up with our reason or our experience. And such doubt is not weakness, but the strength we cherish in every other area of life to help us make decisions and to move forward with integrity. This is hard to do in Christianity, where talk of our sinfulness and inadequacy has knocked the self-esteem out of many of us. We have a lot of relearning to do. Another problem with doubt is that Christianity has promoted the idea that having faith equals certainty. The more certain we are about what we believe, the greater our faith. A friend of mine became increasingly excited exploring some progressive ideas, but when I mentioned this to a mutual friend, he said, "Oh, she's lost her faith." More of us need to lose our faith if this is the case. The ex-primus of the Scottish Episcopal Church, Richard Holloway, wrote, "The perils of being right points to some of the dangers in religion. Our certainties in a world where so little is certain can make us haters and persecutors of the certainties of others, something that religion is all too prone to do. But by contrast, our doubts and our loves can cause all sorts of lovely flowers to bloom, such as tolerance and compassion. Faith has to be co-active with doubt, or it is not faith, but the opposite, certainty. More faith and less certainty would make the religions of the world more humble and compassionate, something that is devoutly to be wished." In our postmodern world, we are learning to live with uncertainty and even to celebrate it. I have called uncertainty the gift of the church because it allows us to move forward, as in science, open to whatever we may find, rather than constantly shrinking back into a closed room and leaning on the door to keep out any new ideas or experiences. Now, while this may feel safe, it's not real life, because we live every day with doubt and uncertainty. My revolutionary moment with doubt was finally realising that it was not an aberration, but an ongoing necessary part of faith and life. They danced together. I used to pray that all my doubts would go away and I would permanently arrive as a believer. Once I was blind, but now I see, is how other people talked. But this is ridiculous, because as culture and knowledge changes, new challenges are made to religious ideas. Life is a journey where doubts constantly produce new answers and new doubts. We live this way in every other aspect of life. Think about it. Why not in religion? Doubts are not red warning flags, but auditors of our belief systems. Doubt is the divine discontent that allows us to hear new voices. As successive bottoms fall out of doctrines that no longer fit our worldview, we don't lose faith by asking questions. We open ourselves to nudges, urging us towards growth. Doubts are those nagging inconsistencies that force us to challenge the status quo so that new light can emerge. We need to celebrate them as gifts, drag them out from under the rug and dust them off. As Paul said, if Christ makes you free, you shall be free indeed. But it can be reversed. If Christ does not make you free, that is, if what you're taught is not liberating good news, you are in bondage to an inadequate belief system. A lot of water has flown under the bridge since my book was first published in 1995, hence the revived version. We are now in a postmodern era where, as Australian commentator Hugh Mackay says, we have the freedom to choose our own realities, to distrust theory, to reinterpret the past, and to incorporate uncertainty into our worldview. The internet has shown us how many alternatives there really are, and we've entered a time when we can keep our options open. We can wait and see, and where doubt and uncertainty have become respectable and celebrated. People are learning to trust their own experience and their reason, listening to the world around them. We no longer make gods of all people in authority, whether lawyers, doctors, or priests. We are encouraged to think for ourselves. Consequently, there have been many religious mini-revolutions in and outside the church in recent years. Today, we're reading the writings of the Jesus Seminar scholars who make scholarship about the historical Jesus accessible to the general public. Yet their first book was only published 20 years ago. The book that projected Bishop Jack Spong into the public eye, those books were published around the same time, as was Marcus Borg's groundbreaking book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, published a year before my book on doubt. The blossoming of progressive Christianity around the world has also happened within the last 25 years. This isn't to say that questioning is new. We can find pockets of heretics throughout church history who ask awkward questions and challenge the ecclesiastical status quo. But this current momentum of small questioning groups is new, meeting together sometime in churches, but often initiated and led by lay people meeting outside churches because their doubts have not been welcome within the walls. Claims long protected by the scaffolding of religious tradition are being bombarded, even though many church institutions are unwilling to let them fall. The public marketplace is now full of books, inviting us to think, and scholarship is no longer exclusively belonging to religious institutions to selectively dispatch. We need to be open to new scholarship and trust the doubts that arise when our reason challenges theological givens. Theology, no matter how obscure and abstract it might seem, is simply the limited attempts of human beings to talk about God from their particular experience and place using the available knowledge and language. We all need to do our own theology and find a working theology that can function in our personal, professional, and public lives. Of course, we can't read all the theological books that have been written, but we're responsible to choose what makes sense for us so that what we believe is not somebody else's truth. Finding a working theology is not once for all, but a life process that involves that constant dance with belief, faith and doubt. This is why I wrote my latest book, Testing Tradition and Liberating Theology, Finding Your Own Voice. As I said before, to give lay people a history of the changes in theological thought down the centuries so they can realise that there's never just been only one way to think and that doubts have always been at work to move people into new thinking for new times. How can we change this fear of doubt that lingers in some churches? First, we have to recognise it as a natural, essential part of life and work and ask loudly and consistently why it is being demonised in religious traditions. This may be a big call for us if our challenge is to the authorities. Letty Russell, who was a pioneer American woman theologian, knew the dangers of challenging her male colleagues and teachers in the 1950s, especially about the role of women. Rather than make direct statements, Letty repeatedly asked why. Where does that come from? Who said that? When certain theological claims were made. Rather than simply dismiss her as a difficult woman, her male colleagues then had to answer her questions and produce evidence for the claims. And after enough why, they had to admit their truths about women's place were culturally shaped, not theologically based. How can we affirm doubt and disagreement in faith communities without it polarising or causing some people to leave? This is the big question for churches where progressive thinking is engaging some and not others. The most obvious answer is creating communities of love and respect that do not depend on uniformity of belief. It's hard to refuse to listen to someone's questions if you respect them as a person. We need to create safe places of hospitality where doubts can be expressed without fear or ridicule or a fall from grace. Many people struggling with theological doubts are the backbones of their churches, and so as long as their doubts about core doctrine are seen as unacceptable, they will keep quiet in order to stay with the camaraderie of the faithful. Clergy can help here by introducing in their sermons the scope of theological debate over certain beliefs that is produced over certain beliefs that has produced these different options of thought. Simply knowing that others have asked the same questions and that there is more than one answer can give comfort and validity to doubters. A minister from my childhood took me out to coffee after I had finished my first degree in religious studies. Now I was in the club, as it were. He listed all the doctrines he didn't believe. I was very frustrated, as he had been my minister as a teenager. And I had listened to his sermons, struggling with doubts over these very doctrines, yet never a hint of questioning had passed his lips. When another clergy person told me he didn't raise these issues in his sermons because he didn't want to pull the rug out from under people who've never questioned them, I told him from my experience talking around churches that the comfort rug is already pulled out from the majority of church people and those who've left. And people long for a new theological rug underneath their feet. An hospitable space giving permission for everyone to doubt includes the pastor. Many clergy preach certainties on Sunday and weep alone during the week in an arid spiritual desert. A new book, Caught in the Pulpit, Leaving Belief Behind, is a study from Tufts University in America linked with the Clergy Project, which is a private website providing a safe haven for clergy who no longer hold all the beliefs of their denomination. Many of them are still in active ministry, caught in financial needs, loss of faith, or lack of other skills. They went into ministry with confidence, but once in parishes, they encounter troubling experiences, whether rejection of their scholarship, dishonesty, corruption, doubts that increase while religious beliefs slowly depart. One clergy person said, "You can't be completely honest up there. If you start to have doubts, you can't share that. People don't want to hear that, and you want to keep your paycheck and keep your congregation growing." But what if pastors could share their doubts and uncertainties from the pulpit? Questions about who or what is God, or about the divinity of Jesus, inviting the congregation on a joint journey of exploration. Such religious communities then would become less like testimony meetings where only your successes are reported, and more like a scientific conference where people share their successes, failures, doubts, hopes, celebrating them as the normal dance of life. Australian Uniting Church Minister John Smith talks about the progressive trinity of doubt, deconstruction, and discovery, which I find helpful. Once doubt is seen as a friend rather than an enemy, deconstruction of doubtful dogmas can take place. We can ask questions about the relevance of biblical laws that were shaped in ancient desert culture, what to eat, what to wear, whom to marry, and which gender we can love. We can accept the equal humanity of women rather than recruit patriarchal Greco-Roman hierarchical codes as God's will. Such deconstruction has a habit of accelerating once the pillars of a literal inspired Bible and infallible church and creeds have been removed. And it can be an exhilarating ride for freedom until the reality of what now and what's left prevail. For many people in Christian churches, this move from traditional beliefs is not an instant experience. It can be a slow chipping away of old layers of old truths, with recurring periods of uncertainty and fear, as much that was treasured has been discarded. In the process, local churches can become impossible for us if the worship is still encrusted in the language and theology that we are abandoning. We long for a community where we can say what's in our heart without fear of rejection, and yet we don't wish to leave our friends as if we are in the wrong. For many in small communities, there's also nowhere to go. The third stage of this progressive trinity after doubt and deconstruction is discovery, which continues for a lifetime. The dance of life where doubts play their stimulating and essential part and allow us autonomy, that self-determination and independence of mind that nominates ourselves as the final authority in matters of faith and belief for us, using our reason and experience. The opposite, heteronomy, means a passive surrender of our authority to an external rule, whether scripture, tradition, creeds, doctrine, clergy, or family. I've talked a lot about celebrating doubts in general, but what specific doubts plague many people today? One of the biggest problems is how we read and interpret the Bible, especially in a faith community. For some people, the Bible is the inspired, inerrant word of God. If not directly dictated by God, as Muslims see the Quran, God has guided the hands of unknown scribes so it cannot lead us astray, which, if we think about it, raises questions when we see thousands of denominations that have emerged from reading the same book. Because of this idea of an inspired book, community-splitting debates about ordination of women bishops are not so much about the people involved, but about what the Bible says or does not say about women. The debate about teaching intelligent design along with evolution in schools is not so much about science or education, but about what the Bible does or does not say about creation. Many people who defend the Bible in this way have little knowledge of how the Bible came to be and how its contents varied over time. With any other book of such magnitude, we would ask questions about authors, origins, editing, about contradictions in the pages, and different genres of myth, metaphor, and poetry. But this has been discouraged with the Bible. It's become for many simply a magical item to carry underarm as a sign of faith. When the church is confronted with the hard social and moral questions, letters to the editors in church papers demand that we go back to the Bible, quoting the odd text here and there, as if this book enmeshed in ancient desert cosmology and lore is unquestionably applicable for every aspect of 21st century life. Yet these same folk are selective with the texts they use. Jesus healing blindness with dirt and saliva is rarely advocated today. Yet the words from 1 Timothy, "I permit no woman to teach or have authority over a man," still denies ordination to women in some denominations, even though the previous verses, "women must not braid their hair or wear gold, pearl, or expensive clothes," are dismissed as culturally outdated. On whose authority is this selection made, and who stands to benefit? I agree, we do need to go back to the Bible. But there we're going to find, along with noble thoughts and actions, divinely sanctioned violence, abuse of women, acceptance of slavery, and some very skewed family values. As Marcus Borg said, we need to take the Bible seriously as our guide to faith and life, but not literally, especially when outdated laws are used against people, whether they be women, gays, people from other religions. We need to distinguish between culturally bound words in the Bible and the word or spirit encountered in these ancient stories and in our lives today. This puts the emphasis where the Bible does, on the spirit always working through tradition, reason, experience, and scripture, helping us to discern what is useful for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness, as the Timothy verse says. Once we allow ourselves to see the Bible as the writings of various people in ancient times to describe their encounters with divine mystery, we can ask the bigger questions that lead to doubt. Questions about God. Anything we say about God, even the three-letter term God itself, is metaphorical, since we have not seen God. And our metaphors matter because they determine how we will act towards God and even if we can believe in a God at all. Metaphors are word pictures that are borrowed from particular cultures to help people describe something that's otherwise hard to describe. And they will work best in the culture in which they were created. They're also limited by the knowledge of the time. Thus they can enlighten, confuse, or deceive when transposed into a different era. Let's have an example. In central Bougainville, down near Australia, the willy wagtail lays its eggs in the open, but the golden plover nests have never been found. According to the local story, a spirit asked Wagtail to do something and Wagtail failed the task. The spirit then gave the plover the same task, and the plover succeeded. The spirit told Wagtail that because she failed, she would always build her nest where people could steal the eggs. Plover, on the other hand, would lay its eggs where no one could find them. To this day, no one has ever seen a golden plover nest in the North Solomon Islands. This wonderful tale is true for those people, but they didn't know that the golden plover never nests in the Solomon, but breeds in the Arctic before flying south. They created their truth within the limits of their knowledge, but they lacked one vital piece of information. So it is with metaphors we use for God. As humans are always limited by their small grasp of the world, which serves as a warning to us all against using ancient God metaphors as truth for today. The Bible came out of a tribal culture where God was described as a warrior, destroying Israel's enemies by the edge of the sword, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep and donkeys. Joshua. Because of this warrior metaphor, violence in God's name has been justified down the centuries. Didn't we all sing, "Onward, Christian soldiers, going as to war with the cross of Jesus going on before"? Is this divine mandate to kill still valid in our complex world today, where weapons are so deadly and leaders so in love with military power? It makes us ask what God images were in place in Christian Germany, the leader at the time of European scholarship that created and justified a culture of violence and anti-Semitism that lulls so many Christians into complicity. Some Christians will say that this violent Old Testament God was replaced by the loving, non-violent New Testament God. Yet the traditional explanation of Jesus' death, coming from the context through Anselm of feudal medieval England, describes a Father God affronted by human disobedience, demanding the murder of an innocent son in the cruelest, most demeaning form imaginable to satisfy divine affront, all in the name of love. The God metaphors we use determine how we act towards God and whether we can believe in God at all. Images of God as an aging male on a heavenly throne, micromanaging every deed that happens on earth in response to the fervent prayer and the divine whim, can't survive in a scientific age. Unfortunately, our hymns and liturgies are full of God images from a pre-scientific age with its three-tiered universe. Sing praise to God who reigns above, and the Lord Jehovah reigns, and his throne is built on high. We need metaphors for God that at least sit comfortably with what we know of our universe today. Recently, NASA announced it has discovered 7 Earth-sized planets orbiting the nearby star and relatively well positioned to support life. They're roughly the size of Earth and roughly the same distance from their star. The science reporters began to recount the literally billions of planets in the universe and how these new planets are roughly 40 light years away. Hearing this, I was again bowled over by the paucity, the ignorant arrogance of our theological language describing God, with metaphors from ancient desert culture and medieval theology. Theologian Sally McFaid puts this need for rethinking the triune God in perspective. She says, God is embodied in one place and one place only, in the man Jesus of Nazareth. He and he alone is the image of the invisible God, Colossians. The source, power and goal of the universe is known through and only through a first century Mediterranean carpenter. The creator and redeemer of 15 billion year history of the universe with its 100 billion galaxies and their billions of stars and planets is available only in a 30 year span of one human being's life on planet Earth. That claim, when put in the context of contemporary science, she says, seems skewed to say the least. The beauty of new thinking has been the permission it has given us all to doubt, to ask questions and find a theology that fits. Let me leave you with the words of the late Charles Birch, an Australian scientist and dedicated lay theologian. To take risks is the safest thing for a Christian to do. The sturdiest faith comes out of a struggle with doubt. One thing I know for sure, in the business of living, one must not live with certainties, but with visions, risks, and passion. Visions, to see the future in hope and expect the best of people and situations. Risks, to venture forth in faith and not count the cost. Passion, to feel with all one's heart, to show emotion, to share one's deepest experiences. This is to be saved by hope. Thank you.